Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we begin our program today by taking a look at the DARE Project. Joan Houston Hall, our guest. She is the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. There's the acronym DARE. And always fun to have her on to talk with us about what's going on with the project, how far along are they, and certainly to take your questions about words that you may have come in contact with over time and wonder about their origins or what they mean. I hope you'll join in with those kinds of questions and other questions as well about the DARE Project. If you would like to call, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. And Joan, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us again. Now, it's been, give us the history on it. It's about 40 years or a little more than 40 years now, isn't it?
A little more. Officially, it started in 1965, but it had been brewing before that for several years. And the concept of the dictionary actually goes way back to 1889. With the founding of the American Dialect Society. But it took a while to get going.
And Fred Cassidy. Did. Yeah, Fred Cassidy was a big part of getting it going.
Yes, indeed.
He was very instrumental in it. And this is not a small task, is it?
It's a huge task. The field workers who went out to 1,002 communities across the country between 1965 and 70 gathered about 2.5 million responses, which we need to deal with. But we also work with written sources from very, very early documents, letters, biographies, histories, novels, poems, up to very contemporary information. So far, we have more than 50,000 entries and a lot of quotations to support those. So there's a huge amount of information in these volumes.
And we have four volumes finished, and the fifth and final is a year or so off down the road?
Yes, coming soon. In the fall of 2011, we will publish from SL to the end of Z, and I'm happy to be able to tell you what the very last entry is.
What is it?
It's Zydeco.
Zydeco. Now, what does that mean?
Well, all of you music fans will know that. This is a kind of music characteristic of Louisiana, Cajun music. Has very strong rhythms, has washboards as part of the ensemble.
Sure.
It used to be very limited in scope, but in recent years, as music groups have expanded their tours and repertoires, more people are familiar with the term. But I think it's a great word to end up the volume with.
Oh, I love it. And you talked about, you mentioned people going out and interviewing. That had to be really a time-consuming, but a fun process as well. I've had a chance to read the newsletters that come out, and they're always fun to hear. On occasion, you'll talk about what the interviewers had to say.
Yeah, the people who went to do the interviews were going to communities they knew nothing about. They were going cold, had to find people who had lived there all their lives, who were willing to spend a huge amount of time answering questions, because the questionnaire was very, very large, 1,800 or so questions.
Wow.
So this was an amazing task, and many of the field workers have written about their experiences in our newsletter. So if people are interested in reading these, they're certainly welcome to do one of two things. They can go to the DARE website, which is www.dare.wisc.edu, and check on news and newsletters and read all of them. Or if you'd like to get a hard copy, just send me an email, jdhall@wisc.edu.
Well, I tell you what, they are really entertaining to read.
They are, yes.
Do you have, maybe you could share, just to give our listeners an idea, share an experience or a type of experience that those interviewers might have had.
Well, remember that this was in the late 60s, and things were pretty much in turmoil throughout the country, but particularly in the South. And some of our field workers who went to Alabama and Mississippi with a word wagon, we called it, a van that said University of Wisconsin on the side, found that things were pretty tense. So some of them recognized early on that to be safe, they needed to check in with the sheriff or the police department very soon, because some of them were actually kicked out of town.
Oh, boy. But and that interviewing has gone on for over a period of time. How long did that interviewing last?
It was only 1965 through 70, so yeah,
Six full years.
But that doesn't mean that our information stops at 1970, because we continue to scan books and newspapers and all kinds of written materials, and now digital libraries. So when we publish Volume 5 in 2011, there will doubtless be some quotations from 2011 in that. So we span the whole history of a word, whether it starts in 1650 and goes only to 1890 or starts much later and comes up to the present. We try to give the whole history of every word.
When Fred was alive, I think it was considered or thought that the primary users would be teachers or maybe linguists or librarians, possibly.
Yes. We certainly knew that libraries would be big purchasers of the dictionary, and they certainly are. But we've found lots of other users, too. And one of my favorite examples comes from a forensic linguist who tells of seeing a ransom note that was put on the porch of the parents of a child who'd been abducted. And part of this note said, put the money in a diaper bag on the Devil Strip at the corner of 18th and Carlson. Well, where could he find out about a Devil Strip? What on earth is that? It's not in Webster's Third. It's not in the Oxford English Dictionary. It's not in any standard American English dictionary. But it is in Dare. And a Devil Strip is what we in Madison often call the terrace. It goes by lots of other names, the parking strip, the berm, the tree lawn, the boulevard. It's that strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street. But Devil Strip is used in a very limited area, almost solely in the area outlined by Cleveland, Youngstown, and Akron, Ohio.
Oh.
And it turned out that one of the suspects on the police list was a man from Akron. And when he was confronted with the linguistic as well as the other evidence, he confessed.
Oh.
And the child was saved.
Oh, so Dare helped save a life.
Exactly. We were very excited to hear about this.
Oh, I would imagine so. Oh, boy. By the way, you can join in. If you have a question or comment, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Give us a call. And I understand, too, it's been used by folks making movies.
It has. Last of the Mohicans people contacted Fred Cassidy, who was able to tell them about contemporary language from the time of the writing of the novel. And he was instrumental in getting them to use British and Scottish accents appropriately. Also, we have tape recordings from all of the people, or many of the people who answered our questionnaire. And when Diane Keaton was making Crimes of the Heart, she borrowed our Mississippi tapes so that she could get the accent right.
Oh,
and
man.
Other dialect coaches and actors routinely get in touch with us so that they can hear accents from all over the country. And we're very happy to be able to provide audio tapes.
So you have tapes in addition to recordings, in addition to the print version then?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that down the road, eventually, this may all be online.
Yes, we are making plans now for the electronic edition. And one of the things that would really be wonderful in that version would be to be able to go to every quotation where we cite one of our informants from an audio tape and have people be able to click on that link and actually hear the recording.
Oh, boy. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
You think you're gonna, well, That's going to cost a little money. How has the project been funded? A variety of sources, I believe.
Yes. Over the years, the National Endowment for the Humanities has been a major sponsor, and we are incredibly grateful to that organization. The National Science Foundation has also been very supportive, as has the Andrew W. Mellon mm-hmm. Foundation. But we have many, many individuals who simply love language, who want to see us get this finished, who also are regular contributors, and we're grateful for all of them.
Oh, I would think so. Well, let's take it. What are some of the favorite words that you have that that appear in there?
Oh, well, why don't I talk about some that are coming up in Volume 5?
All right, let's do that.
People haven't seen yet. How about upscuttle?
Upscuttle.
Yes, an upscuttle is a disturbance, a quarrel, a fight. This is a word that's found chiefly in the Appalachians. And as often happens when a word is either restricted or found chiefly in that part of the country, its roots tend to come from either Northern Ireland or from Scotland. That's one of the common threads in that part of the country. Or how about winklehawk?
A winklehawk.
Yeah, winklehawk is found in the Hudson River Valley. It's pretty old-fashioned now, but for a long time it was very common. That's a right-angle tear in cloth, and it comes appropriately from a Dutch word.
Oh, so do we have how many dialects of English are out there? I mean, how was it organized? I mean, how did you organize to find all these words?
Well, there are many, many dialects, and as you won't be surprised to hear, they tend to overlap because language doesn't follow state boundaries or even regional boundaries. As a generalization, it's fair to say that the basic dialects of the United States result from the patterns of immigration from the very first part of the history of the country. So, for instance, one of the things that's clear in general is that people in the South and people in New England share one distinctive feature, which is the lack of a post-vocalic R. So instead of saying farm, they'll say fam, mm-hmm. and it's far. Instead of far, it's fa, and that kind of thing. Well, that simply reflects the places where the original settlers came from, because that was a characteristic of those parts of England, whereas people who settled Pennsylvania early on had a rhotic R, a mm-hmm. post-vocalic R, and so they would say farm and far instead. Well, those kinds of features hold on for a long time, and as people move west, they take those kinds of speech features with them. So people moving west from Pennsylvania with their pronounced R's, settling through Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, would bring those features. And of course, later on, as people came from other parts of the world, they brought their own features of their language,
sure.
which were effective in terms of their learning English. So,
fascinating. Well, Orville in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Miller. You're a veteran here. Can you tell me who Dr. Cassidy was? I'm curious, because when I was an undergraduate at the University of West Indies in Kingston, we had an English professor by the name of Dr. Cassidy, and he wrote a book called Jamaican Talk, and I was wondering if it's the same person.
Indeed it is.
It is?
Yes. Fred Cassidy was born in Jamaica.
Oh.
He lived there. lived there until he was 11 and then moved to Akron, Ohio.
Yes.
He came to UW in 1939, and in the decades after that, he went back to Jamaica a number of times. For,
yeah, but I think I saw him once, and I was going to school there.
You might well have.
Yeah, wow.
And he did write Jamaica Talk, and yeah. he also wrote the Dictionary of Jamaican English.
Wow, okay. I thought it might be him.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Joan Houston Hall, our guest, chief editor for the Dictionary of American Regional English. As we talk with her, we're going to go to Steve in Madison in just a minute, but there's a line open for you, too. Give us a call with your question or comment, maybe a word that you want to ask about. The number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the Dictionary of American Regional English and our English, our dialects here in this country. We had a rich tradition across this country with so many interesting dialects. Fun to have Joan Houston Hall with us, chief editor for the dictionary, to talk with you and with me. And again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Steve in Madison next. Steve, hello.
Hi. I had a question about I grew up on the Oregon coast, and we always used a term out there, the word to piece, as in snacking on leftovers.
Uh-huh.
And I've never run across anybody in Wisconsin who knew that way. The only person I've ever run across who was familiar with that meaning was from Pennsylvania.
Well, that's very appropriate. It starts in Pennsylvania and moves pretty straight across the country in that band across Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, clear to the West Coast. And we call it chiefly North Midland word and West. So it's appropriate that you know it from Oregon. I know it from California.
Oh, you do? Oh, well, good. Well, you're the second person I've talked to.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Roger in Bessemer, Michigan. Let's turn to you now. Hi, Roger.
I'd like to know if the lady knows how the Southern people got their accent. Why do they speak that way? Is it because of a combination of Irish, Scottish, English, or what is it? And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling. That Southern drawl, I think he's probably talking about.
Yeah, it certainly does go back to the original dialects. One of the interesting things that we've found in DARE, and this has to do with vocabulary more than accent, though both are related, is that often if we find a word that's characteristic of the South and is also characteristic of African Americans in the South, it often turns out to be found in the Scottish National Dictionary.
Oh.
So there were lots of Scots who went throughout the South, and many of them had jobs on plantations and working with large numbers of African Americans who then learned their dialects from these Scots English-speaking people. So both the pronunciations of people in the South and South Midland and many of the vocabulary items do come from various specific areas of England.
Thank you very much for calling. Bill, let's turn to you in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Sure. Another kind of Southern question. My mother was from Georgia, and she had a lot of terms, in fact, but one that she used to use if something was kind of bent out of shape, she would say that it was wonker-jawed.
Mm-hmm.
Ever heard of that?
Yes. Volume 5 will have a whole series of things like whopper-jawed, womper-jawed, wonker-jawed. you name it, it's probably found.
So it was something from the Georgia area?
Well, these are actually pretty widespread.
Are they?
I don't know that any particular variant has a very restricted distribution, but some of them may be more common in one place than another.
Than another, mm-hmm. Sure. There you have it, Bill. Thank you for calling. Randy and Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a word that my mother used off and on all the years. She still uses it once in a while. It's called nip-shitting.
Nip-shipping.
Nip-shipping. It's called nip-shitting. Nip-shitting is what kind of the term, the way she says. She said it's eavesdropping on somebody else's talking on the phone.
Well, that's new to me.
It's in Wisconsin all her life, and she just called it nip-shitting. That's what it is. And she said it's eavesdropping on somebody else when they're on the phone.
Well, I'll keep that in mind and look for more evidence.
Nip shipping. All right. Let's turn to Alfonso in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I have two questions. One, it comes off the caller who just made the call. I'm curious how you do follow-up. You know, I mean, this is not a Wikipedia-type thing, so that's one question, how the follow-up works. And then the other question is, I'm from the Southwest. I'm from New Mexico. And so I'm curious how the original research proceeded in the Southwest where Spanish language was salient. And I'm wondering how follow-up work might proceed, you know, in that kind of unique linguistic situation where you might say there's renewal and change, you know, the ebb and flow of Spanish spoken from other parts of the world as well as from Mexico, how that kind of moves up and renews the Spanish spoken in the Southwest. I will hang up and we will listen to your answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Well, we did find in the Southwest that there were many, many words from Spanish that are used in a very natural way in an English context. And that was our criterion for entry in DARE. It didn't matter if it was a Spanish word as long as people were using it in their English conversation. So there are lots of words having to do with physical features of the geography, things like arroyo or ristra, that string of peppers, things that are culturally important. But we didn't very much get into Spanish syntax or grammar or that kind of thing. It would certainly be interesting to follow up on that line, but it would also be interesting today to do the field work all over again and to see how change has occurred over the last 40 years. Unfortunately, it would be extraordinarily expensive, and I suspect that no agency is willing to fund that. But you asked about follow-up. Nowadays, it's very much easier to do person-to-person follow-up, and a good example of that is the research we were doing on the word squid a number of years ago. It turns out to be a very New England word for a little scrap or fragment of something. And all of our information was from New England, except for one little bit of information I found on the web that came from Palo Alto. Ah. I thought, oh no, this New England word has jumped clear across the country. So I thought, I've got to go on this website and find out where this person learned this word. So I emailed him, and within 5 minutes, he got back and said, oh, yeah, I know that word. My girlfriend's from Maine, and she used it, and I'd never heard it, and so I thought it was cool, and I started using it.
So there you have it. So that's how it jumped, sort of.
Yeah, and that kind of follow-up can be done today, and it's very much easier than it used to be, but we can't do that for every word.
Let's turn to Alberta in La Crosse. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Where did the phrase "cute as a button" come from, and why did they use a button to say with the reference to cute? Oh.
Well, you know, I'm not sure. My guess is that it goes way back in English and probably can be found in the Oxford English Dictionary. So I would check there first. If you have access to the UW Electronic Library, you can do it that way, or your local library should have it.
Yeah, that's buttons, I guess, maybe way back when were pretty cute. Who knows? Let's go to Don in Green Bay. Don, hi to you.
Hello. One of my favorite words that my grandmother uses, it's probably an abbreviation of what you call it, but she used to say what you call. And it was kind of interesting because after a while we just said that and we, you know, sometimes the younger kids didn't always know what grandma was talking about. And then, of course, the favorite very regional word that I love up here the most is, of course, bubbler.
Yes, bubbler is a good one. It isn't restricted to southeastern Wisconsin, but that certainly is the focal area for it. And we discovered some time ago that a good reason for that is that the area where people use the term bubbler is also the area where the Kohler Company marketed a bubbling valve that they called a bubbler in about 1918 or so.
And I can recall, just on that one, I can recall a drinking fountain that bubbled up right in the middle. The water kind of came up and bubbled out, and it just made sense to call it a bubbler.
It did, yes.
All right. Thanks, Don. Carol in Appleton, on to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm from Indiana, and a lot of my relatives in the southern part of Indiana speak a Hoosier dialect. It's really rather different. But one thing that they use is the term ewins. And I figure it must have evolved because in other languages, there's a term for whether you're talking to a single person, you, or a room full of persons when you say you. And just like down south, they'll say you all. I think that may have started to include the whole group. And what they do down in southern Indiana, they had the term ewins when they're talking to a group full of people.
Yeah. Actually, it's a lot more widespread than just southern Indiana. It's a pretty South Midland-y term, and it's found in Ohio and West Virginia and Pennsylvania. And it certainly serves a good function because, as you say, we don't distinguish between you singular and you plural. So there are lots of other ways to do it, such as yous, or ewins, or y'all. And all of those will be in Volume 5.
Well, I kind of figured that a lot of my family history tree traces back to Ohio.
Uh-huh. Well, that makes sense.
It could be that they brought it with them.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Huh. Okay.
Thanks, Carol.
All right.
Appreciate the call. Here's an email from Herb. Does the word kerflutz or kerflutes appear in Dare? Any information on its origins or multiple meanings? I first came across it in a letter my grandfather sent to my father in the 1930s about how his uncles wanted to capture the Scotch cap market and went kerflutes or kerfluts.
Well, there are lots and lots of ker words like kerflummix, kerflummix, ker this and that. And I don't know that we have kerfluts. We have kerflui and...
No kerflutes.
Oh, I don't see it on a quick check. But that prefix, ker and also ka and kull and kor, and those kinds of things are extraordinarily productive. And we have a very long entry for ker as a prefix, showing how it can be put on all sorts of stems to make these kinds of onomatopoetic and very effective kinds of words.
Somebody wondered, what's the origin of the word till as in cash register? Would till be a dialect?
It's not the kind of thing we would put in Dare, so I would suggest we're looking in any standard dictionary, American Heritage or Webster's New World or Webster's Collegiate. Any of those would probably have that, but I'm sorry, it's not on the tip of my tongue.
And Dennis is reading personal letters of a young man who came to rural Richland County from Ohio in the late 1850s, living with his young wife in a log cabin and breaking new land. And in a letter to family members in November of 1861, he concludes with these sentences, "For we are here away from the discontentment of others, and while such is the case, I would just say that we fear not the game sayings that may be produced against us, but that is not all. I do not think there is any person here now that I can say that I am hanging around all the time and sponging off them, for it is now out hog or die." Out hog or die.
Usually that phrase is root hog or die, so that's interesting. I don't know that we have this particular variant.
I wonder if it wasn't root hog or what is the root hog or die?
Oh, well, I'd feel better checking than giving you something off the top of my head, but it'll only take a second here.
We'll check that out. Joan Houston Hall, our guest today from the Dictionary of American Regional English. Looking up a little phrase here.
Okay. We say that it means to work hard or suffer the consequences, such as to fend for yourself, to struggle for existence. So you're going to have to root hog or die.
And And if it was written in handwriting, maybe it did say root hog.
It's possible.
Just,
yes.
He's just reading it as out hog or die. Mm-hmm. It might have been root hog or die. All right. Susie in New Berlin up next. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I'm wondering, I'm not sure if you'll be able to do this, but I have a word that I've been trying to find where it comes from. My grandpa, who grew up in kind of the Mayville area in a very German family, I think they spoke primarily German, out on a farm, and they had something we still make called Gratzen. Have you ever heard that word, Gratzen? It's kind of like a cross between scrambled eggs and pancakes.
Gratzen?
My mom always supposed that it was because they didn't have enough eggs to feed everybody. They didn't have enough pancake mix to feed everybody. They mixed it all together and kind of made it like scrambled eggs.
Well,
and
that's
we called it Gratzen. And we still, like I said, we still use the word. We still use make the stuff.
I Any don't idea? Know what that is. I'm really
spelled?
Interested in it.
That would be like Grotzen, Gratzen?
I've never seen it spelled, so I don't know. There's no recipe for it. There's, you know, we've just always made it. And my mom, like I said, my mom said she figured it was probably either a mistake, somebody didn't turn the pancake right and ended up just smushing it all together, or there just wasn't enough, or I don't know. We didn't know if it was a German word. We couldn't find anything from our friends that speak German. They had no recollection of that.
Often these kinds of things are archaic and come through in spoken dialects but haven't been recorded in dictionaries. Mm-hmm. So it could be one of those.
Yeah.
And Gratz certainly sounds Germanic.
Sounds like a sneeze to me. I don't know.
Well, how's it taste?
Oh, I love it. It's a really rich pancake.
Oh.
Yeah, except that it's all kind of scrambled together. Like I said, you just pour all of the batter in the pan at the same time and just kind of start turning it like you do with scrambled eggs.
Uh-huh.
So the eggs all broken up in the, because people are going to.
You make pancake batter, but instead of putting, you know, maybe two eggs in, you put six eggs in.
Oh.
So it's really rich. And I still love it. But
I'm glad you told.
You know, we just never heard the word. And I don't know any. Actually, I don't know anybody else that makes it either. So,
well,
it's our family.
You probably. I'm sure there are going to be some people who are listening who are going to give it a try.
They're going to give it a try. Yeah.
Thanks, Susie.
That's true. All right, thanks.
Joan in Rolling Ground. We're on to you now. Hi, Joan.
Hello. I'm curious about the word passel. P-A-S-S-E-L. In 1958, we moved from rural Wisconsin to rural southern Indiana and learned a foreign language. And then when we moved to Minnesota, some words I never heard again.
Uh-huh.
But then recently I saw passel in a book spoken by an African-American woman in Florida and heard it on the BBC, an Irish woman in Dublin. So I'm really curious about this word.
Yeah, well, actually, it's fairly widespread. It used to be chiefly in the South and the South Midland, but it has spread from there. And it's a variant of parcel. So a passel of whatever is a bunch of it or a bundle of it. And it's a very useful word.
It is. I like that word.
So it's more widespread, even though I never heard it again.
Right.
Yeah. You know, we always find that we think that the things we know are what everybody else knows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a surprise to think, oh, my gosh, I never heard that. Or I know that, but you never heard of it?
Yeah, because in Minnesota, when I started to use it, people would look at me strange like I was speaking that foreign language.
Thanks, Joan.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call. Well, Marty in Milwaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Marty. Marty, are you there? Oh, we lost Marty. Let's go to Scott in Milwaukee. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a phrase that keeps on going through my head. My grandfather used to use it, and my father still does now and again, but he doesn't really know what exactly it means. Now, my great-grandfather came from Prussia, and they came and settled in Iowa, and I don't know if it's German or Polish, but the phrase is Shishta Bajunka, and I've done my darndest to find it online, and I don't know even know how to spell it.
Oh, my.
Oh, man.
And that's definitely more than one word.
We may not be able to. It's not in there, I'm pretty sure.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know where you'd begin to look for to find out what that.
I think you need to start with a Polish speaker or.
A Polish speaker?
Someone who has a background in that.
All right. So find somebody who speaks Polish and start there, Scott. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Bill in Appleton, on to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was on the telephone with customer support in Oklahoma about a year ago. Larry, you may appreciate this. It was some fishing electronics.
Ah.
And they were malfunctioning. So I was talking to this technician, and she said, so after a while, it goes all hinky on you, presumably meaning, unpredictable and wild. And I had never heard that word before, hinky.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it. And actually, we have an entry for it, meaning insignificant. But I think this hinky is a little bit different. We have an entry for hinky-dinky, meaning something that is not very important or that gives poor service, such as a branch railroad. I think I've heard hinky as just something that's kind of out of shape, but we don't seem to have it here.
Oh, but hinky dinky, it might be a short version of hinky dinky in a way. If it's something that goes haywire.
Yeah, that's possible.
As with the railroad thing that you're mentioning. Yeah, that could be. But I've heard hinky too.
I have never heard. I had never heard it.
Well, there you have it, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I'd suggest that you look in slang dictionaries for that, and it might be that we didn't include it because it felt more like slang than regional English. There's a wonderful resource called the Historical Dictionary of American Slang, and there are also some smaller slang dictionaries as well. So try that.
And Kathy emailed to ask, I listen to WPR's old-time radio drama every week, and I've noticed that some of those actors and many local folks north of the age of 65 speak quite properly, pronouncing each syllable clearly and distinctly. Was this careful manner of speaking taught in school? Is it a familiar thing, something that affects all ages?
Well, I think in the past, say our grandparents' generations, there certainly was a greater emphasis on public speaking and rhetoric and diction. That's not to say that nobody does it anymore, but it is often true that people hear younger people speaking today and think, my goodness, why can't they articulate? I think it depends on the context. Certainly radio is a place where one has to speak clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So, while there are people who throw up their hands and say, young people today just can't speak, I wouldn't say that that's a good generalization.
And on that note, we have to close. And Joan, the website again for DARE?
www.dare.wisc.edu.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
I'd love to.
Thank you so much. Joan Houston Hall, Chief Editor for the Dictionary of American Regional English. Always a great time when she comes by, and we definitely will have her back again. Coming up, we're going to talk about how you can make your best airfare purchasing decisions. Rick Seney of Dallas, Texas, CEO of FareCompare.com. Our guest coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.